spoils to go around. Brave decisions so easily made by men who won't serve on the ground. Don't need any reason, don't need any proof to start dropping bombs on their heads. The quarterly profits have gone through the roof. Don't think of the wounded or dead. Breathing in hate, living in fear. Peace would be great, but it won't happen here. Breathing in hate, living in fear. Peace would be great, but it won't happen here. We hear religions that talk about peace, but actions speak louder than words. The dove and the olive branch long cast aside for bombs, tanks, bullets, and swords. My God has always been better than yours, and so we must fight to the death. I stand above you, I pray to my God. I watch as you draw your last breath. Breathing in hate, living in fear. Peace would be great, but it won't happen here. Love conquers hate, hope conquers fear. Never too late for the peace to start here.
Returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman. You're listening to everything you wanted to know about drone warfare, but were afraid to ask.
Great. I see we have a long line of folks lining up, and I hope we'll have time to take all of you and even more. So let me start with our first person, Professor Bunke.
Good evening. My name is Bruce Bunke, and I teach a course here at Holy Cross on intelligence. I share many of the concerns that the speakers have raised about the use of drones. And I particularly believe that we overuse them. But I have a question which may not on the face of it seem like it relates to drones, but I think you'll see where I'm going in a couple of minutes. Hopefully you'll see where I'm going in a couple of minutes. My students sometimes aren't sure, but anyway. President Eisenhower, during the 1950s, implemented a three-part defense strategy for the United States. One of those parts relied on using the CIA to conduct covert operations to advance American foreign policy interests. Now, Eisenhower understood perfectly well that covert operations are often dirty and immoral, and that innocent people get killed. President Eisenhower's calculus, his perspective, looking at the extraordinary number of casualties during World Wars I and II, casualties both military and civilian, he came to the conclusion that covert operations, which, as I said, may be dirty and immoral, on balance, are better than the extraordinary number of deaths that the two world wars of the 20th century had generated. So my question is, can this perspective be applied to the use of drones?
Anybody who would like to. But let's keep the answer total, maybe 2-3 minutes, no matter how, if there's more than one person that would like to speak to us, we can maximize the number of questioners we can reach.
I question the presumption that if we hadn't engaged in covert action, starting with Eisenhower, to the present time, we would have had World War III. That seems to be the presumption that somehow we avoided wars by engaging in this kind of activity. I'm not sure. One of my concerns, frankly, is that as drones become more globalized, that this will be a very real risk of sparking more armed conflict because, again, of the ease with which they can be deployed. And so they're tempting to deploy, and so they will be deployed. And, of course, when we deploy them, people are not going to come and attack us, but other countries are not, don't have such fail-safe defenses. They don't have militaries that dwarf the 20 next countries combined. And so the risk is that this becomes a trigger to more conflict. And I think a better response is law, international law, the ban on the use of force, except in response to armed attacks, and the Geneva Conventions, than engaging in secret killing.
Avery?
Yeah, I think the essence of the question is, do you want your leaders sometimes to get their hands dirty? Do you think that it's part of being a good leader if you face a situation in which the country would be protected, for example, if you did something that was unethical, that we would expect them to do that? Would we want them to do that? I think that the truth actually is that often we want them to do it and not to tell us about it, and then we want to have the gratification of complaining about it afterwards when we find out that they didn't tell us about it. I think that the truth is that we want it both ways. And probably if we want our leaders to be responsive to us, we need to be responsible in telling them what we want them to do. It's probably good that we're having these debates and trying to work out some of the ethical issues that are connected with this. But the other part of it is we should try to send back a clear message about whether we want our leaders to be doing what's necessary to protect us, even if it's in a legal gray area, or are we willing, where there's a real conflict between them, to uphold the exact letter of the Geneva Convention, even if it puts us at significant danger. And I think it's great if we can, as is sometimes claimed, do both. And obviously, if we can protect ourselves better by using the Geneva Conventions and using the laws, that is fabulous. And that's an easy choice. But the hard question is, what do you do when they don't converge?
Yeah, and that kind of argument is exactly what got us into torture, Guantanamo, and Abu Ghraib, which
there's
I think
always an assumed outcome. Okay. Great. Thank you. Professor Bunke, we need to move on. I'm sorry, there's a whole bunch of folks behind you.
I just want to say one final thing.
Very quickly, please.
I want to turn the microphone over to the next questioner. I did say it was a three-prong strategy. The first prong was nuclear deterrence of the Soviet Union. So there was no presumption that we were heading toward World War III.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
Next questioner.
Thank you. After the U.S. dropped atomic bombs in World War II, there has been a race to gain nuclear weapons. This race caused an international crisis during the Cold War, and now as North Korea and Iran try to become nuclear, the U.S. is trying to contain the numbers of nuclear countries. A similar pattern, some argue, can be seen with the space race, the militarization of space. So my question is, will we see an international security crisis as more countries get drones? And if so, are the gains from our current strikes worth the future costs?
Greg, do you want to start?
Sure. I think that's a very good question, and I think the point that David has raised a couple of times today has been particularly apt. The U.S. is killing people right now that the U.S. identifies as terrorists. Not everybody in the world identifies those individuals as terrorists. And there is, I think, a very real possibility, which will soon, I think, become reality, in which countries like Russia or China use this. And what exactly the U.S. response can be when Russia uses a drone to kill someone outside of Russian-controlled territory that the Russian government claims is a terrorist, that the U.S. does not see as being a terrorist, is going to put the U.S. in a very dangerous position. And I think that has been the failure of foresight from both the Republican and Democratic administrations that we've had under President Bush and President Obama. I think the U.S. has often had leaders who look at the present with one eye and look at precedent with the other. And I don't think that's happened over the past 10 years.
The fact is that there are 50 countries that either have drone technology or have developed it themselves or have purchased drone technology already, and many of them are well advanced on arming their drones. Iran has a drone that I think they call now the Ambassador of Death. It doesn't actually fire missiles, but it flies into things at the moment. But no doubt they'll find a better way eventually.
So far, not so lethal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, lethal if you're where it lands, but that delivers its embassy of death to you directly. So I think that this is going to be a proliferation that's going to occur in the next 10 to 15 years, and it's a fact. And it's a good thing if we could set clearer norms and conventions that would restrain the use of drones in the future. But I would caution that I think we may also be tending to exaggerate what our impact is going to be, because when 50 countries have drones and they're being used broadly, there's no assurance that other countries are going to follow the example that we set. So it's not enough just that we do it in a way that we're comfortable with. If you really want there to be norms, we're probably going to have to develop like an international convention, some treaties, to make it part of the ICC, for example, to oversee drone use. If you want these to actually restrain the behavior of other countries, there's going to have to be more institutional oversight.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Yeah, next question.
Yes, hello. My name is Claire Schaefer-Duffy, and I have an observation and a question. On this matter of effectiveness, it's always a relative term. And I think, David, you pointed out we are here in Worcester, but CNN is possibly seen by our Pakistani friends. So what is effective from our perspective is not necessarily effective from theirs. And particularly since we are at a Catholic institution, it's not measured solely on nationalistic terms, but more on what is effective for human beings. That is my reflection. But the moral dilemma that it's not even a dilemma to me, it seems like a huge moral problem. Putting that in one place, although it should always be in the forefront, isn't this a game changer in statecraft? Just the fact that you have one country doing targeted assassinations, violating national boundaries, isn't that a significant change in just the way states, the rules in which states can interact? And isn't that contributing to the difficulty that the U.S., that Pakistan is having, and any kind of alliance that the U.S. can make with some states like Pakistan where, you know, what are they going to do? We're allied with Americans who periodically happen to bomb our citizens now and again without giving us a heads up. So that my question is asking about that. This isn't drones, aside from being this shift in technology, isn't it a shift in the way states can engage with one another?
I think that's the risk. As I said, I think it makes it reduces the disincentives to using lethal force in another sovereign jurisdiction. I think what the administration would say in response to that is, well, we only use it in another sovereign's jurisdiction if, A, they agree to it, and allegedly, although again, because they don't acknowledge these things, we don't have anything public on this, but behind the scenes, we're told, Yemen consents, Pakistan consents, Somalia consents,
But look what's happening to Pakistan.
They're
crumbling, and we're losing a functioning ally there.
That's the effectiveness argument, which, you know, I think is a very serious argument. You know, serious enough that Dennis Blair, who was the head of one of our major counterintelligence operations under both Bush and Obama, now says that putting all questions of morals and ethics and law aside, we shouldn't be engaging in drone strikes in Pakistan because they are counterproductive. They make us, and the world, and the world for us less safe, not more safe. I don't think I have the ability to second guess him on that judgment, but I think that is certainly a concern. And you know, I think imagine if another country were, you know, regularly dropping, you know, precision bombs out of the sky and killing, people here.
Yeah,
and imagine that, you know, 86% of them were bad guys, or even 95% of them were bad guys. How would we feel about some other country asserting the power to just push a button and, you know, even if it was done with the so-called secret consent of our government, secret because the government couldn't possibly tell us that it consented, because we would put that government out of office if we knew that it had consented to another country executing us, right? That's the situation in these places. The reason the consent is secret is because it cannot be public within those countries, just as it couldn't be public in this country. Underscores the difficulty.
Claire,
the problem.
But I think we need to move on, because there's a whole bunch of folks behind you. Avery, did you want to jump in on that, or Greg?
Well, I would just say, you know, diplomacy is incredibly difficult, and I think the problem that we see in places like Pakistan, in places like Yemen, in places like Somalia, is that these countries, from the perspective in Washington, have simply become too hard to do. And the idea is that if the U.S. can fire enough missiles and kill enough bad guys, it can keep al-Qaeda and groups like that back on their heels to the point where they can't sort of plot, plan, and launch attacks against the United States. I find that strategy to not be very, very effective in the long term, and I'm worried about some of the consequences that we may reap as a result. But there are real concerns diplomatically.
Avery?
Yeah, I think that if you want to establish a convention to govern the use of drones, particularly outside of the spheres of conventional armed conflict, like theaters of armed conflict, we will have to accept that as an implication, that if a situation arises where there's a terrorist group on the territory of the United States and they're carrying out a pattern of attacks on our neighbors, let's say Canada, they're repeatedly attacking Ottawa, trying to blow up the Parliament buildings, and there's a series of attacks, and the Canadians get really upset, and we don't do anything to stop that pattern of attack from continuing, then the Canadians would have the same right to carry out drone strikes against that terrorist group that's continually attacking them as we're claiming to have in the case of Pakistan. It may be a very beneficial thing to try to create some kind of rules and regulations, but they will have implications for us as well.
Okay, Tom has informed me that we have 5 minutes left, so why don't we take three questioners, and I apologize to the folks who are four and five there, but why don't we take three and just give us your questions and then sit down, and then you guys can do it the best you can in the remaining time. Would that be okay? Thanks, guys.
So it seems that one of the biggest things that we have going on with this unconventional warfare, the fact that we're not exactly fighting a state-bound enemy, is winning the hearts and minds of the people in the countries that we are in or that are now seeming to go against us because we fire more and more missiles. So I guess my question is, the more missiles we fire, which seems to be the consensus on, oh, this is how we either win or it's how we're not winning, can drone warfare really coincide with winning the hearts and minds of the people of these countries?
Thank you. Next two questions, and then you guys can finish up.
If President Obama and the United States government had planned a mission involving special forces to capture Anwar al-Awlaki, and during the mission he was killed, would there be the same discussion of the government's power to kill U.S. citizens that is going on right now?
Professor Cole, this is primarily for you. A few months in July, you wrote an article in the New York Review of Books, and basically one of your primary arguments was making a comparison between the policies of the Bush administration and the Obama administration in terms of a grounding in the rule of law for the Obama administration versus certain policies that you saw as reprehensible. One of them you mentioned tonight is torture. And as a professor, you know, of law and someone very well versed in that, and you obviously view torture as something that is unequivocally illegal in as a tactic, how do you sort of bridge the gap between torture and the use of drones, which for I think a lot of people is viewed as something that has a very tenuous link to legality in terms of signature strikes and collateral damage?
Why don't we start with David and then let Avery have the last word? Go across.
Well, I go back to what I said at the beginning of my initial remarks, which is torture is never permissible. Under the Convention Against Torture, it is clearly and expressly prohibited, even in times of war, full stop, end of story. If you're going to be within the rule of law, you don't torture. You don't take people and waterboard them 183 times. That's what we did. You know, it was considered to be necessary. It was considered to be the dirty work, blah, 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 blah. That's what we did. That's not acceptable. What I think the Obama administration has tried to do is figure out what is use lethal force and maybe overuse lethal force in response to the terrorist threats that we face, but to figure out how to do so within the confines of the rules of law. And they have, you know, the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki, you know, spawned an 83-page memo that, you know, applied the various legal standards and concluded that under these, you know, specific conditions, which included imminence, included non-feasibility of capture, included operational leader who had engaged in these attacks against us, that was legal. You know, I think those are hard questions. You know, one thing that we all three of us agree on is that you can't rule out the use of drones as a pragmatic matter or as a legal matter during war. Killing is appropriate. The challenge is in defining the appropriate scope. Whereas you can, and we did before George Bush, rule out the use of torture. So I think that's the principal difference between the two administrations. In that same piece that you refer to, though, I then went on to criticize the Obama administration for a variety of tactics, including in particular the drone policy.
Right. So briefly, can drones be compatible with winning the hearts and minds? I think absolutely. It's not the drone strikes per se. And we've talked a lot about the different strikes that are happening. We don't always know what's a drone strike and what's being launched from a conventional plane or what's coming from a naval ship. It tends not to be the mode of the weapon delivery system that are upsetting and driving recruitment in these places. It's not even the deaths of key and high-level al-Qaeda leaders. It's the mistaken drone strikes. It's the civilian casualties. These are the things. And so if the U.S. were to use drones much more judiciously, if they were to take signature strikes off the table, and if their drone strikes were to actually be backed up by hard human intelligence on the ground, then we go a long way towards, I think, winning the hearts and minds. On the issue of Anwar al-Awlaki, I absolutely think that the U.S. would still be having this debate, because Anwar al-Awlaki isn't the only U.S. citizen who's been killed by a U.S. drone. There have been three others in Yemen alone. And let me just close with two quick points. One, in referencing the Department of Justice, the white paper that came out, it said that a senior qualified official in the U.S. government would determine who is a senior operational commander within al-Qaeda. There's a very real assumption there that the U.S. has, if not perfect, near perfect intelligence about what's happening in the inner workings of al-Qaeda. I think that's a very dangerous assumption to make. And one of the things, as I said, I've been going to Yemen since 2003, spent a lot of time on the ground. I've talked to a lot of different people. One of the things that's been most frustrating to me over the past decade is that the U.S. is self-evidently right in this. The U.S. has more technology, it has more munitions, it has more men, and it has more money. And yet, on the ground, in a place like Yemen, we appear to be losing.
I think that drones are a tactic. They're one instrument of trying to deal with a deep-seated, complex problem. And they cannot solve that problem for us. They can be one element of the solution, but they need to be part of a complex strategy, which involves more intelligence, involves their modulated use and their focus on the leaders, decapitation of leaders, because that has the greatest impact and produces the least blowback. But not just the strikes themselves. They have to be part of a diplomatic strategy to build up the government and to its authority and credibility with the people through closer cooperation as well. So that hopefully addresses the immediate American interests. But there's also broader questions that are raised by drones in terms of how they're going to be used in the future. So we have to think not only about our own interests and our own strategy in the next few years, but how drones are going to be used down the line. And I think that David raises an excellent point when he accuses us of an attitude of exceptionalism. We can't be thinking in terms of what we can do because we have the power to do it now and what will advance our immediate interests. We also have to give consideration to how other people will use drones down the line and try to build institutions and regimes that will restrain their use. And I think that we do have to think about what their implications will be for us as well in the future. And it's not necessarily a terrible thing if countries have a disincentive to permit terrorists from operating from their territory. Or there's a way for other countries or international institutions to put pressure on countries that do allow that by using drone strikes. Drone strikes can not only for our own interests, but in terms of global stability, can be a positive force if they're regulated properly. And that's something that we have to think of beyond the scope of our own immediate concerns.
In conclusion, the New York Times noted last month that, quote, the Air Force is now training more pilots for its drones than for its fighter jets and its bombers combined. So this is only the beginning of what seems to be a long policy. And I think in addition to what David pointed out as the commonality among the three speakers, that they all agree that in some conditions, under some conditions, drone use is wise, I think they would all also agree that more debate about when and how to use them is necessary. So in that spirit, I thank all of you for coming. I thank you guys, most importantly, for helping us start that debate. And thank you guys for coming.
That's all, folks.